You are listening to Social Europe Podcast. We discuss cutting-edge thinking on politics, economy, and employment and labour with some of the most thought-provoking people around, including Nobel Prize winners and other internationally acclaimed experts. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.
Hello and welcome to Social Europe Podcast episode 30. My name is Henning Meyer, Editor-in-Chief of Social Europe. Today I'm in conversation with Tim Dixon, who is a former speechwriter to several Australian prime ministers, and we talk about the Australian Labour Party and social democracy in more general. I hope you enjoy the conversation. So Tim, thank you very much for joining me this morning to talk about the case of the Australian Labour Party as part of our SWOT analysis project that Social Europe runs together with the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung. And in order to get us into full swing, the first question would be, you know, in the political system of Australia, what is the historic position of the Australian Labour Party and where does it currently stand?
So Australia's got an interesting story on social democratic politics because it actually had the first national Labour government in the world, if I remember rightly, from my days as a Prime Minister's speechwriter. I think it was 1908, perhaps. It's certainly the one to win outright. So it had early origins going back to the 1890s and the trade union movement. If you think over the period of now, it's sort of 120 years, it's been in government less often than the conservative parties who've generally governed in coalition. But it has been national government around about a third of the time. Its most successful time, you'd say, was the 1980s and 1990s. There was a national Labour government that's regarded by universal consent as a very successful reforming government. Had a shorter time in government more recently, from 2007 to 2013. But Australian politics has also got the same electoral contest at a state level with six states. And in fact, Labor more often has governed at the state level than the Conservative parties. And there's, even in some of the quite conservative states of Australia, like Queensland in the north of the country, it's essentially been in government almost unbroken for the last 30 years, just with a couple of sort of short, one-term governments in between. So it's a story of being the major alternative government to conservative parties, to having several periods in government, generally quite short. But as I say, at the level of the states and more the service delivery that the states do, it's actually been the dominant party.
Okay, and if you look at the current situation of the Australian Labour Party in relation to, let's say, other parties, maybe next door New Zealand, but also sort of European counterparts, maybe also to the US Democrats, where do you currently see its position and particularly strengths and weaknesses?
Well, it's stronger than in most other countries. So in European countries, we see the decline of social democracy, but that's partly because you've got multi-party systems, and so votes leak in many directions to the Greens and sort of similar left parties, but also to the populist parties. In Australia, the populism has not been as strong. It's been much more clearly on the right as well. It has certainly seen a fall in the way Australian politics works, because it's got the alternative vote or preferential system. We think in both the primary vote terms, and so the Labor Party has gone from having low to mid 40s to generally mid to high 30s in primary percentages. But because it comes down to final preference vote or alternative vote between two candidates at the individual electorate or seat level, in most cases, those votes that go to independent or green parties come back to the Labour Party. I mean, the overwhelming proportion of them do. So even when you get a low primary vote, even if it's only 30, 32, 34%, you still actually elect Labour candidates. So as a result, it's a much more dominant party. There are very few seats that are not held by either of the major parties. And that's obviously very different to the situation in most European countries. It's more similar to the US, although not the same, because there are minor parties. And so there is a contest on the left with the, nowadays it's with the Greens. It's been other parties in the past. And there's some insurgent parties on the right. And certainly when a strong independent candidate stands in any seat these days, they stand a good chance because there's the general disenchantment with the political system that we see throughout the world. But that has not translated into a decline in the position of the party in the way that it has. And I think that just comes down to the actual voting system. It just tends to, because of preferential voting, it tends to direct the votes back to the major parties. In terms of the current polling, there's a strong expectation that Labour will win government in the election, which is due in the middle of 2019, although it could happen sooner. The Conservative parties have been in power only for 4 years now, 4.5 years, but they're really struggling with incredible internal tensions, really between the more liberal and more hard right conservative forces internally. New Zealand is a useful comparison point because the countries are quite similar in their position, European cultures in the Asia Pacific region. They have just elected a Labour government only in the last few months, in really what was a surprise election, a quite successful and relatively stable conservative government there that had been in there for quite some time, for about a decade. But they had a change of leader. Their new leader wasn't as popular. Labour, very, very late in the electoral cycle, elected a young woman to lead the party, only 36 years old, not well known. And she just cut through very, very well to the population. And again, I would say voting systems are important. The particular voting system, the multi-member system they have in New Zealand produces a different set of results because of its structure. But they have just got over the line to return to government. So the situation in sort of Australia and New Zealand in that respect is quite different because it's a story of strengthening Labour parties. But I would still say that the underlying forces of disenchantment with the overall political system and a sort of a willingness to try alternatives, that's still there. But it's been masked by those aspects of the system. And also, I think the other thing is economic success. You know, Australia in particular went through a really strong boom period, kind of similar to Canada, I guess, is the most comparable of the Western democracies during that period, the decade from 2003-2004. And so there were really substantial increases in per capita income coming off that because of iron ore and coal and other exports. So that has just meant that the kind of pressures of austerity and the stagnation in wages has not been a part of the Australian experience until recently. It's just beginning to happen, I think, now in the last 3, 4, 5 years. But that has just meant there's been less disenchantment than what you've seen in European countries.
It's an interesting point that you say that, you know, even though the underlying tensions are there, it's masked by the electoral system. Would you say that the underlying tensions that sort of help propel, especially right-wing populism in Europe and other places, are there to the same extent, only masked by the electoral system? Or do you think it's different? I mean, the interesting comparison, for instance, would be in terms of, you know, a country that does economically well is my own home country, Germany, who's been doing well economically, but recently has, well, suffered a severe setback in the Bundestag's elections when the AfD entered parliament with a quite strong showing. And obviously, it's interesting to compare it also to the Labour Party because, to an extent, the first-past-the-post system here in the UK also masks a lot of underlying currents that are going on. I mean, if you look at the Labour performance when Ed Miliband was leader in Scotland, it seemed to the electoral system seemed to mask developments up to a certain point when there is really a tipping point, and then the whole thing, you know, falls over, as when Labour basically lost the whole of Scotland to the SNP. How would you judge what is going on in Australia against, you know, the comparison of those two cases?
I think they're very interesting cases. And I think that the point you make about tipping points is absolutely right, that there's, you can look at superficial, indicators of voting, it's not a superficial indicator, but if you just look at voting figures, you don't pick up the qualitative shifts in people's level of attachment to parties and how much they identify with them. Look, I think the differences are that, I think there's the research that I've been doing most recently, which has actually been, a lot of it's been focused in Europe, is looking at the reasons for the appeal of authoritarian populism. And there's obvious drivers, the combination of terrorism, the cultural and demographic changes taking place, especially high levels of immigration, the economic factors in the decades since the financial crisis, the rise of social media, the sort of loss of trust in parties, all of those factors. I think that the best evidence says that the driving forces in what's going on are actually cultural and identity-based, but economic factors make people a lot more vulnerable to divisive, populist, sort of cultural, identity-based messages. So the countries where you have, like France, for example, Italy, where there's been more economic stagnation, and I think specifically, it's not just stagnation. I actually think the bigger factor is people's sense of confidence in the future and their, what jobs are my kids going to do? What's my kid's future? If people feel good about that, they have a very different resilience to go through periods of hardship. In most Western countries now, people are asking that question. They don't know what the answer is. And it's in that context when they feel an uncertainty about the future and an insecurity about the future, and they see the decline of services around them, the nature of work has become more insecure, and then they see high levels of immigration in that context, and they say, "What on earth? I mean, why are people coming in when we don't even know what jobs our kids are going to do?" And I think that the bigger driver, though, in that story is actually the strength of cultural and identity issues. People are feeling more disconnected from each other. They're perceiving more threats around them. And in that context, that appeal that says there's an other that we need to, that is threatening us, that we need to be protected from. And that if we come together and we draw the lines more strictly and we don't let those people in, then we'll be safer. And that kind of appeal around cultural identity works more in countries that have a stronger and more singular sense of cultural identity. This is where Australia is different, because Australia is an immigration society. 28% of the population was born overseas. 60% of the population was either born overseas or one of their parents was. So it just is a very multicultural society. That's really different to a lot of European societies who are managing much more recent large flows of immigration. And that, I think, challenges identity, challenges that most European societies don't have a strong sort of multicultural or multi-ethnic notion of identity. And it feels like, well, if you're Turkish, then how can you be German as well? Or if you're, Syrian, how can you be Swedish as well, et cetera? And I think Australia is more like the United States in that respect, where it's always had a, it's just been an immigration country. It's a younger country, very, very large numbers of new migrants coming in all the time. So I think that factor, it means that the kind of divisive cultural issues, debates and immigration debates, while they're there, for sure, in Australia, they've actually been channeled more into the issue of refugees. They actually haven't challenged the overall context of a high immigration society in Australia. They haven't changed that. And I think that means just those sort of cultural identity issues that drive populism in most European countries are just not there in the same way in Australia. I mean, they are there, but they just have not been as strong.
Mm-hmm. And maybe that's also a question of time. I mean, after all, the number one immigration country in the world, the United States, did elect Trump on the back of its own history of immigration, right? So I agree with you that there is a combination of socioeconomic and cultural reasons for the rise of right-wing populism. But, from your point of view, how would you suggest should social democratic parties react to this? very tricky landscape. I mean, if you look, for instance, at the electoral map in Germany, large parts of Eastern Germany, the electoral patterns look much more akin to Poland and Hungary than to Western Germany. And you seem to have a pattern that, you know, objection to immigration is located in the places where they are either indeed hotspots, where there are peril societies or problems locally, and in the places where there are no immigrants whatsoever. So, I mean, it's obviously very, very difficult to react to that kind of situation with one kind of uniform policy. But what would you suggest should the reaction be?
So that's right. I think that the challenge that we're facing is that the split between the city and regions, the regional split, which is another way of talking about the split in education outcomes, is increasingly shaping the electoral map in Western countries. And I think understanding what's driving that is the key to the future, probably more than anything else. So one insight that is very clear from the research that I've been doing, which is in France, Germany, the Netherlands, Italy. We're just launching a huge study in the United States at the moment, and we'll be doing some other countries as well next year. The most Western democracies have around 25 to 35% of their people who are essentially liberal and cosmopolitan in their bearings. They have more open values, they're open to change, they embrace globalization and sort of cultural dimensions. They have humanitarian instincts, they're generally quite strong, but sort of liberal instincts. On the other side, probably about 15 to 20% of the population have got strong, hard, more closed views, more fearful of change, resistant to change, and anxious about their country. They're the kind of people who will say, I feel like a stranger in my own country sometimes. And then in the middle, there are people who have got a set of anxieties about change and cultural change and immigration and those sorts of issues, but also have some liberal views and are certainly not, you know, solid sort of closed-minded people. And I think that this is the change in the way that the electoral map looks kind of everywhere, that increasingly we're talking about an identity split between more open and closed values and not the same old spectrum of left to right. The insight from all of that is there just isn't a majority of a population, really in any country, that is simply the cosmopolitans. And the danger for our social democratic parties is that because they're mostly composed of educated, metropolitan, well-educated, comfortable with change and globalization, with those kinds of people, that they're disconnected from an important part of what has always been the base of successful social democratic parties. The answer has to be that we don't abandon we don't become illiberal and abandon. Those people are, in fact, that group is generally the largest group in any individual country. But as it's always been the case, you win government by appealing to a broader constituency than just the one. And I think that's the key. We need to understand more of and not look down on the middle groups, the people in the middle groups. And I think that was in all of the analysis of what happened in the United States in the 2016 election, I think that what's one thing that emerges time and time again is the sense in which people in those sort of middle groups, Midwestern states especially, felt looked down on, felt culturally and in terms of their identity, felt disrespected or distant from the sort of coastal elites of the Democrats. So I think that story, which has been played out obviously very strongly in the US, is at the heart of the challenge that all of the Western democracies face. And I think Australia is actually probably a more mild version of that because of the stronger economic conditions that I described and the fact that it has been a more multicultural society throughout its history. So these dynamics are being seen everywhere because they're being driven by globalization, by the changing nature of work, by all the increased levels of insecurity, terrorism, the sense of a cultural clash in our societies, and all of those things are very similar. And social media is playing a role too because it tends to polarize more and tends to isolate us from the views of other people who don't think like us. But I think that comes back to this challenge of building broad constituencies.
And if we come now to the final part, the sort of opportunities and threats for the Australian Labor Party, but, you know, social democracy more general. I mean, what I find interesting about the analysis that you've just presented and that we've heard elsewhere as well, you know, the difference between the communitarians and the cosmopolitans, is it always raises the question in my mind, what has changed? Basically, what has driven the wedge between those two groups that used to be more united under the roof of social democracy? And it seems to me that you pinpointed a very key point, is that the ones in the middle, the ones who are neither strongly cosmopolitan nor strongly communitarian or closed, as you put it, have anxieties about the future. They don't feel confident. So, you know, is that, from your point of view, is that one of the key things that has changed that has basically helped to break this maybe always fragile coalition? But social democracy tends to do well when there is a positive view, a positive narrative about the future. You know, our kids will have it just that little bit better than we do. But if there's a fundamental anxiety driven by the things that you mentioned, globalization, digitization, changing nature of work, immigration crisis around the world, all those things, you know, do you think that this is one of the key factors that has changed the dynamics of this coalition?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think there is a disconnection between the experience of globalization of, you know, much of the leadership of social democratic parties, because they're successful. They thrive in that environment. So, I mean, it's often stated, but the analysis of the shrinking proportion of political representatives who actually have a manual work background or a mainstream technical qualification, technical experience, rather than a more sort of more highly educated experience. I think that's a really important factor. I think especially true in European social democratic parties, but it's true everywhere. You know, there has been we've become quite institutionalized. I think in the case of probably more so in Europe, again, I'd say, because I think it's the case study where social democracy is fundamentally in crisis and its survival is, you know, is a threat. Look at the Netherlands result, where the vote was under 10% this year. I think in that context, the challenge for us is to go back to our roots. You know, social democracy, in its essence, is about the representation of the interests of the whole community, and especially of ordinary working people. And yet what's happened is the parties, as they've institutionalized, you know, for many generations were successful, were politically dominant, they become institutions of power. I think they particularly became too committed to a state-centered model and failed to realize that the institutions of the state were themselves often a cause of frustration for ordinary working people and weren't necessarily delivering. And we haven't had the mechanisms to hear the frustrations of ordinary people, or we've dismissed them. And there's still too much of that happening. There's still too much dismissal of the anxieties of the middle groups. So, I mean, I think there's obviously many other elements to it. I think that when you have a dominance of older leadership, the underrepresentation of women and minorities, for example, you know, parties can look less, more like the past and less like the future. I think that's a factor in many places. I think on that score, Australia has actually done quite well. The cabinet, the Prime Minister, I said, the cabinets I worked with in Australia, really the majority of their best ministers were women. And I think that was, while Julia Gillard as Prime Minister in Australia got subject to really vicious misogyny from the hard right groups, actually more broadly that masked the fact that a real strength of that government was that it looked more modern because of its composition. So, I mean, I think there's obviously a mix of factors there that sort of play into its success or failure. But I think, you know, not being institutional, being adaptive to an environment where power no longer resides in the established entities, that the social trust has declined, that we need to think about more participatory models of politics. We need to be more representative of the communities that we're standing for. You know, those are all really critical elements. And people are willing, the public is more willing to embrace change, actually, than what the political order has been. And I think that's something that's got to change. We have to be much more willing to be innovative, to try different models. I mean, I think the last thing that I just touched on that's important as well is regional policy. I think that we have to think more about location, so cities and regions, and how we address people's lived experience in those communities. We've under invested in the sort of a policy around that, and I think that your best examples of progressive social democratic leaders in many countries now are emerging from city government, and I think that's a key indicator for where we might go in the future.
Well, Tim, it's been a fascinating conversation. I'm afraid that's all we have time for today, but I hope we can continue this because my hunch is that these problems are not going to disappear anytime soon, and I'm sure we're going to have to refine much more, you know, the policy response to address them. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thanks, Henning.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you don't miss future episodes by subscribing to Social Europe Podcast. You can also read our articles on www.socialeurope.eu and follow us on Facebook and on Twitter @Social Europe. Until next time.